Well, welcome back, everybody. It's good to see you. It's really good to see you. Let's start by kind of leaning in a little bit and seeing each other. If it works for you, turn your video on for a minute so we can take each other in. I think this is a very sweet thing to do. And of course, nobody knows who's looking at anybody when. You can't tell. So don't need to be bashful. Just let yourself be seen. Very nice. Thank you. I am joining you today from the ancestral land of the Wiat, about 300 miles north of San Francisco on the coast in the Redwoods, a little town called McKinleyville. And the sun is shining. It's extraordinary. We've had so much rain. It just became really waterlogged. So it's nice to be sort of feeling like we're coming out of the, I don't know, you know, the depths of water. Anyway, how our morning will go is we'll start out and arrive here with a short arriving meditation. And then we'll talk with each other a little bit, have a little longer meditation, a Dharma talk, and always time to talk with each other. But let's get here. Let's truly arrive. So please find a posture, whatever it is, just for this short time to be here, to arrive and settle. Let the breath come in. Let the breath go out. Getting a sense of the body just as it is. Maybe the mind has got all kinds of things going on from wherever you've been already today. And it's inviting the mind to begin to settle, turning the awareness inward and downward. Sensing all the touch points, everything the body is touching, including itself. And offering yourself these intentions, intention phrases. May I be grounded in my body. Dropping in. And sensing into the heart space, however the heart is today, welcoming that. May the heart become open, soft and stable. And the mind, may the mind become clear and balanced. And with this breathing, letting the breath be at ease. Grounded in the body. The heart open, soft, and stable. The mind becoming clear and balanced. Breathing with ease. Good morning. Good morning. Thank you to everybody for being here, for coming back. Those of you I haven't seen in a while, it's especially sweet to see you, and also very reassuring when you come back, when everybody comes back. Oh, so I want to pick up right where we left off last week, and I'll give a little background for where we left off for anybody who may not have been here. We've been talking about the paramis, the beautiful, mature aspects of the heart that we can cultivate, these aspects of generosity, renunciation, morality, wisdom, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, equanimity, patience. And last week, we spoke a lot about wisdom, and we did it through the lens of talking about, can we take in some, use some inquiry questions that helps us access what we already know, and maybe meet a little inspiration. And we talked about inquiry questions like, what makes a meaningful life? Or what might be the most meaningful part of your day? And it's not what's the best part of your day. That's different. But we're talking more about a deeper sense of what is meaningful. And to access that, maybe asking the question, what do I know to be true? Or what is this path of practice of discovering what is the most important thing? Not as an end point, but as a process. And these kinds of questions can lead us to what we already know, right? Our wisdom, that deep felt sense of knowing, yes, no, not sure, maybe. All of these different ways of knowing this wisdom, this gut felt knowing. And I was thinking about it a little more deeply about what are some of the teachings that help us cultivate the wisdom? Because wisdom isn't something we do. We talked about that last week, that with all of these paramis, there are practices that help us develop loving kindness, develop patience, develop determination, develop generosity. But wisdom happens as an outgrowth of these practices, do you think? Okay, it really is not something you can do. It just is, but we can access it. And so I was thinking about the teachings on faith, Sada in Pali, S-A-D-D-H-A, which sometimes it is often translated as practices of faith, but it can also be translated as trust, confidence, maybe a quality of conviction. I don't think it's actually conviction. I think it's mostly confidence that I can place my heart upon this path of practice. And that's another translation of sada, to place the heart upon, is a kind of faith in whatever it is. And I have great trust and confidence that this is a path of practice that develops my own wisdom more and more and more, or when I forget, that I can come back to this practice of, well, what have I learned? What are the things that really do support me? That accesses the wisdom, and it reinvigorates my trust, my faith in practice. And it's often said that there are four aspects of faith. One is borrowed, starts with a quality of bright faith, then borrowed, then verified, then what's known as abiding. And just like the paramis, you can start anywhere, even though typically this list is taught with bright faith, that quality of excitement. You know, when you learn something new and you say, oh, wow, that's it. And it has a shiny on it. And we can get a little infatuated with, this is it, this is it. And that goes on for a little while until something shakes it. And who knows, like, I've been so blissed out in this meditation practice, and then I go through a cycle of meditation practices, utterly boring, and I'm full of agitation. Whoever said that this was such a good practice anyway, right? So that's where the faith, the trust gets a little rocky. And that's okay. That's just part of how this goes. And so that takes us into this quality of borrowed faith, which says, I'm going to go back to Sangha and see how it goes. And then you might get the vibe. You might get the feeling of, oh yeah, this is why I do this. Or maybe you're just hanging out with a friend and going for a walk, and there's something in you that meets something in somebody else that brings you back, says, oh, right, there is something good here. And we have to borrow that kind of trust and confidence all the time, I think, until it grows and grows and grows, until something happens that it actually gets verified. Oh, yeah, that's good. So when we come back and we borrow, we might be reminded of, oh, this is so helpful, right? And then that verifies our inclination towards practice. It verifies that this is good, which can take us into a quality of what's known as abiding faith. You don't have to question yourself anymore, right? You don't have to second guess the value of this beautiful practice. You might go through cycles where it comes and goes, and that's incredibly normal and common, but you know it's in there. And that's the wisdom, right? There's this wisdom to come back over and over and over again. So that's just a little précis on how we can connect the dots of what we know to be true, what makes a meaningful life, this wisdom that is inside of us, and then nurturing the wisdom through these practices of trust and confidence. It's all part of the paramis, I think. And, you know, the practices of faith and that list don't necessarily show up in the paramis, but, you know, our practice is full of lists. The Buddha gave us many, many lists, and it really, I think one of the things that I trust about these lists is you can pick anything from any list and tug on that thread a little bit, and it will lead you to all the rest. It's all so incredibly interwoven. So the other place we ended up last week was with this beautiful spoken word poem from Andrea Gibson. Do you remember that? Hopefully, yes. So, and I said, we got to watch this again, because we watched it at the end and it was quick. So I want to bring this back, and we'll actually hang out with the wisdom and the faith that is woven into this. And what Andrea said is, lately, whenever I'm having a hard moment, if I see or hear a bird, I'm immediately snapped back into presence. What are the things for you that snap you back into presence? And they say, I truly feel like the birds are communicating with me, whispering their sweet somethings. They said, I took some time recently to imagine what the birds are actually trying to tell me, and wrote it down for you. Where are those places, maybe in nature, that you feel see you or you're supported by? How do we go to the natural world to be reassured? Do we borrow faith to verify our trust and confidence through the earth and the natural world? I don't know. I do. But see what you think. I am going to share my screen, and let's listen to Andrea again.
We sing after the storm. We sing during it. We sing to the blizzard. We sing to the percussion of the hail. We sing to the lightning, and we harmonize with the thunder. What are you doing with your vocal cords? Why on earth are your eyes still closed? It's dawn, and our song is on your aspen tree's radio. Feather your hair and get out here with your high notes. Why stay in bed when you could be high-fiving the sunrise? Human awe is an endangered species. Do not let your astonishment go extinct. Go wild for the wildness of your being. Sing off key and call it a yet to be invented note. Why are you acting like a birdcage caught your heart? No matter what hurts, love yourself enough to never think your ribcage is locked. Just because your life isn't a piece of cake doesn't mean it can't be sweet. We know you've been taught the opposite, but for goodness sakes, think your own thoughts. Don't be a parrot on the world's shoulder. Ask new questions like, what do I have in common with the person who I judge most? Why is loving someone who doesn't love me back a sad tune? Isn't the one who loves the one who is lucky? Consider the possibility that no one can break your trust. It's your trust after all. Write this down with a feather pen. Our emotions are doors opened by our willingness to feel them. You can feel sad without chaining yourself to sadness. You can feel fear without believing that fear is the truth. If that feels difficult at first, just wing it. That's our motto. Just wing it. It is absolutely possible to make a nest of a hurricane, to make a clearing of the fog. Keep asking yourself this question. What love can I make of this loss? Humans are nightshades. You grow in the dark. Does that mean you are made by your pain? No. Does that mean you are made by your decision to turn your pain into medicine for the world? No. You are made by knowing that you can't be made or unmade. Understand who you are without your beliefs about who you should be. Stop clipping the wings of life's magic. Beneath your running mind is a heart that knows that kind of exercise is ridiculous. Every day is a great day to hatch wonder. Rubble the walls between yourself and everyone until you're sure the scenes of strangers' lives will pass before your eyes when you die. If that doesn't make sense right now, it will one morning. When you wake at sunrise, walk out to your porch and see a flock of 10,000 starlings circling above your head. There I am, you'll think, looking up at us. There I am.
Isn't that beautiful? There's so much in that. And later on this morning, we're going to talk about energy, and we're going to talk about determination, those other two of the other paramis of the 10. But for now, I'd really like to know if there was anything in there that really met your heart. And I'd just love to know if any of these lines, anything in particular, really, really drew you in. I mean, there's a line in here that lightens me that says, my emotions are doors opened by my willingness to feel them. You can feel sad without chaining yourself to sadness. Isn't this the Dharma? And then she says, you can feel fear without believing fear is the truth. Just wing it. She says, that's our motto, being a bird. Just wing it. I mean, come on, let's laugh, you know? And sometimes this is the borrowed faith. Just wing it. This is how it accesses our wisdom. What I love so much about Andrea's piece is it's acknowledging the suffering and saying, you don't have to believe that. What's actually happening here? We are so much more than our thoughts, so much more than the fleeting nature of these emotions. Andrea Gibson's very interesting. She has been living with ovarian cancer for a while. And so her view into what does it mean to be alive is very poignant. And they write out of that place of understanding the tenderness of life. You can get her Substack if you go to andreagibson.com. Fabulous. Really, really good. You know, it brings us to this I'm looking at my notes. Another of her lines, each day is a great day to hatch wonder. Each day is a great day to hatch wonder. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, who said, don't miss it. You woke up again, 24 more hours. Can we listen intently to what's happening? All right, so let's move into our meditation. And find a comfortable posture. We'll sit for about 20 minutes or so. And let yourself be comfortable, yet in a posture that fosters this attentiveness. Do what works in your body. And even if you're reclining, which is totally fine, see if you can get a sense of the uprightness in your body, of energy supporting you, this commitment to staying present, being here. If you'd like to close the eyes, do that. Otherwise, have a soft, gentle gaze downward. Again, a sense of being grounded in the body. The sense of touch and connection, belonging here in this moment. And coming into the space of the heart and whatever is here now, letting it be here. All the different energies, the full range of joy and sorrow and comfort and discomfort, liking, disliking, fitting in, not fitting in. All of it being here, letting the heart become open, soft and stable. Again, turning the awareness, the mind downward, dropping in, letting the mind become clear and balanced. The breath comes and goes. Let it be at ease. Sensing the inhale. Sensing the exhale. And even the space before the next inhale comes in. Letting the mind and body assume the natural ease and peace that is the natural ease and peace of this mind and body. When the mind floats off somewhere else and you notice it, come back. Be gentle with yourself, yet persistent. Being here. As you settle in, if you notice anywhere in the body that may have some discomfort, pain, whatever it might be, send some caring energy down throughout the body. Invite it to soften. And at the same time, the invitation to soften, there's also the invitation to stay present, sensing being here now, awake, attentive, alive. kind, open. And we'll sit quietly. Again, sending in softening energy down through the body, especially to any place that has some habitual holding. Might be the jaw, the shoulders, the brow, wherever that might be. Listen in, sense in, soften. noticing the stillness that's emerged, how the body really is still, how the heart really does soften some, and how the mind really does become a little clearer, a little more balanced. Letting stillness do its work on us. Accepting that and resting in this stillness. Now coming more directly into the space of the heart. If you like, imagine breathing in and out of this heart space. In from every direction, the back, the front, sides, above and below, diagonals, nurturing the entire heart space. And as you breathe out, back out into all spaces, all directions, sharing your goodness and also releasing whatever you want to release. This heart's breath, the receiving and the releasing, the receiving and the offering. Trusting in your own good heart. To know what is right, to know what you need. To know when it's time to let go. Trusting in the wisdom of this heart. This is called Future by Jacqueline Susskind. I can't see my future clearly. It's a wash of color and light. Maybe a glimpse of a house with wood floors, the death of a parent, a dog, a cat, a love, but nothing certain. I like its fog. Inevitably, something will happen. Pieces will fall into place if I keep breathing, and I'll eat, I'll work, I'll learn, and know and forget. There'll be another bowl of berries, a hot cup of tea, additional travel and sorrow. There'll be a clean pair of pants, the sun's good glow, a cut and blood, a hole to dig, a bath to take, a mistake to mend. What lies ahead is a promise standing in shadow, 1 second pasted to the next. I don't need to call it by name. A riddle ensues, a song of guessing, a vow of risk. The road becomes itself, single stone after single stone, made of limitless possibility, endless awe. Welcome back, everybody. A couple things that I have coming up. Twice a month, I offer a Sunday Sangha, and it's very sweet. It's online. You can drop in. Some of you already know about it. It's on my website, pacificmindfulness.com. Carlita will put it up. And you just have to check the calendar. It's not regular, like the second and fourth Sunday of every month, which would be nice if I would do that, but it doesn't quite work out in the calendar. So come anytime. It's 10:30 a.m. to noon Pacific time. You're welcome anytime. And if you are interested in an online or in-person retreat, I have a very sweet retreat coming up in April that is a poetry and meditation, Dharma, and writing retreat. And you can check that out as well. The online component of it is very, very accessible if in-person doesn't work for you. And anyway, check it out. I would love that if you did that. All right. So the end of that poem called Future. What lies ahead is a promise standing in shadow, 1 second pasted to the next. Isn't that how this is? We don't know what's ahead. 1 second pasted to the next. I don't need to call it by name. Like, can we live in this mystery of not knowing everything? A riddle ensues, a song of guessing, a vow of risk. You know, when we step into this life wholeheartedly and this commitment to being present, we're actually taking a vow of risk. I am willing to be here. The road becomes itself, single stone after single stone, made of limitless possibility, endless awe. The theme, can we stay with this quality of astonishment and awe? And I think it doesn't have to be this big, bright thing. It's a quality of appreciation. Appreciation for our lives, for one another, for what is here, for what is not here. The beauties, the losses, the continual cycle of what is happening. So after last week, I got some requests of what to talk about on these next paramis. And one of the questions was, I've never really quite understood the paramis of energy and determination. Can we talk about that? And so that's great. So that's what we're going to do. And I invite anybody to write to me anytime, Heidi@pacificmindfulness.com, and tell me what you're thinking about and what you would like to study a little bit, and we'll do it, because this is what we're doing together. This is a collective exploration, and I do want to know what you are thinking about, and also what your thoughts are on this. How does the Dharma meet you? So these beautiful paramis, there's a central question, I think, to all of the teachings, and to bring in particularly now, is how do we understand something? And then how do we experience it so it becomes real? Because we can study whatever we study, and we can have a concept. We can get it conceptually. But then when we see how it actually shows up in our lives, that's when it becomes so real. So this quality of energy, sometimes thought of as effort, is a quality of keeping it going. You know, what is the energy we bring to practice, to being present? The Pali word is virya, V-I-R-I-Y-A. It's a quality of indefatigability. Like, I'm not going to get fatigued. Or when I do get fatigued, I'm going to find the ability to come back. It's such an odd word, indefatigability. I had to say it about 5 times to get how to say that. So this is what Sylvia says about it from her beautiful book, Pay Attention, For Goodness Sake, which I recommend to everybody. It's a beautiful book on the paramis. What she said is, I feel an invigorating consolidation of my energy, striving to be here now. Each time I realize that now is the only time anything happens, and that every now disappearing just as rapidly as it arrives has been shaped and created by a habit, and in its fleeting existence is shaping and creating habits. I know that my experience of a peaceful, happy mind depends on developing the habits that support it. Since habits are, by definition, deeply ingrained patterns, and all moments are immediately lost, I need to enlist every moment to teach me about suffering and the end of suffering. Knowing that I haven't a moment to lose keeps my energy high. A vow of risk, right? It is all fleeting, 1 second pasted to the next, and it does create the habits. And so our practice over and over gives us the confidence and trust that we can have the courage, the wisdom, the love to get to know ourselves deeply from the inside out or from the outside in. What are my habits of being that really support who I am, really support my well-being? And what are my habits that maybe not, right, that aren't so great? And can I have the courage to undo those habits? So this quality of energy, right, I need to gather my energy to be willing to stay, to be here now, because I can't do today over again, right? I can't do today over again. And obviously there are days we don't want to do over again, but can we even be present for those times? I used to be involved in rowing. I love to row single sculls or crew. And I was never a competitive rower. I was on this rowing team. It was the rec league, you know, the middle-aged ladies rec league. It was really, really fun. And the coach was somebody who came from a competitive coaching experience. And I don't have a competitive bone in my body. I really don't. I love to participate in lots of things, but competition makes me go the other way because I just really want to have fun with it and enjoy it. So we were out there one Sunday morning, rowing, and I was really enjoying the view. I was really enjoying being there. And I hear the coach yell, using my last name, like, who calls a middle-aged lady by their last name to begin with? It's really weird. But Born, he says, put something on it. I thought, put something on it. I'm doing it. I'm on keel. I'm doing it. And I looked at him and I said, what's the problem? And he said, put something on it. So I got it. I needed a little oomph. And it is really true. When you add a little oomph to whatever you're doing, it brightens it. You know, I mean, maybe the keel is better. Maybe the boat goes faster in that case, which is true. So when we're in our practice, and we can talk about it literally as meditation practice, you know when you need to put something on it. You know when the sleep is coming, when you're making grocery lists or, you know, whatever else is going on, except for being here. That's when you come back and remind yourself, actually, this is in this formal practice right now. I am going to be here. I am going to stay here with whatever is happening here. A vow of risk. And maybe it feels risky sometimes because maybe it's not so comfortable in there. And can we give ourselves the courage to show up? Or maybe it doesn't feel risky at all. It's just a vow to be present. And some days it's risky and some days it's not. You know, it's all over the place. But I think it was Bhikkhu Bodhi who said, just do two things. Begin and keep going. Begin and keep going. And we need to bring this virya, this total commitment to practice towards developing this clear, peaceful, kind mind heart that is so important. I heard somebody say yesterday, I think, sometimes I pray for the world and sometimes I pray for myself, and they're different. I don't think they are, because we are so intricately connected that if I pray for the well-being of the world, I'm really also including myself in that. I'm not separate. And so we have to trust. I think we trust that what we do really matters. How we show up matters. It doesn't mean that we can always show up in our best selves, obviously. But we begin and we keep going. And then in those times that we're dispirited, we borrow the faith. We come back to what we already know because it really bolsters and buoys us. There's a story you may have heard of one student who was going through a difficult time in their practice and had been through the natural ups and downs of, I love it, I don't love it, I love it, I think I'm leaving, I love it, I'm coming back. All of that you know. If you've been doing this any length of time, you know this is how this goes. But we remember to remember. And one day he came to his teacher and he said, well, I finally figured out how to remind myself. And on his palms, on one palm, he had tattooed, I love you. And on the other palm, keep going. And he said to his teacher, so every time I get stuck, I can look at my palms and it says, I love you. Keep going. That's a quality of virya, of reminding of the faith that we're doing this ultimately, we hope, Because we do love ourselves. And in loving ourselves, we are loving each other. We are becoming a force for good that is true. It is really true when we show up, even if it's sad, even when it's a hard day, when we show up honestly from our hearts. What a gift. Can we make a vow to love ourselves more? I don't mean it selfishly, and I don't mean because it leaves anybody else out. But that is part of this energy, this practice. So maybe you think about, why are you here? What brought you here initially? Why do you keep coming? Revisiting your motivations and intentions for pursuing spiritual practice at all. Connecting to that which brings meaning in your life. And my hunch is that's what we're all doing, is being very close to what is meaningful, because it's a lot more interesting and nourishing to be close to meaning than not, right? And why are we, you know, you can ask yourself that question, what brings me to spiritual practice? It might be as simple as, I want to feel better. Most of us have some of that, for sure. Or it might be, I'm just totally curious, what is this thing? Could be lots of reasons. Maybe getting very curious about what happens when you meditate. Like really getting curious about the meditation. Noticing the different energies in the body that come and go. Noticing how the mind comes and goes, or noticing, wow, I can feel my heart in ways I've never felt it before. Or some wisdom arises just from being still. But it takes energy to notice that. And then there's some quality of energy that says, come back, hold still. Teacher Bonnie Miyotai Treece, she says, commitment to any practice means not moving to something easier. When it gets difficult, the challenge has been to stay. All right, not moving to something easier. The challenge has been to stay. There's this really funny cartoon, actually, that comes to mind that shows two dogs, each sitting on a zafu, and they each have a candle in front of them, and they've taken their collars off, and they're also on the floor in front of them. And one dog says to the other dog, I think the trick to meditation is learning to stay. I think the trick to meditation is learning to stay. And that is the pith instruction, right? And it takes some energy to stay, just stay, make the choice, the decision to stay. So are we experiencing restlessness? Okay, stay. A discursive mind, stay. Fear and loathing out of control, stay. Aching knees and throbbing back, hunger, stay. What's for lunch? Stay. What am I doing here? Stay. I can't stand this another minute. Stay. This is how to cultivate steadfastness, openness, kindness, strength, courage, is the ability to come back, the vow of a risk, one moment pasted to the next. Pema Chodron says, the real work of the practitioner is to find the soft spot in the tenderness in that very uneasy place and stay with it. If we can stay with the soft spot and stay with the tender heart, then we are cultivating the seeds of peace. Isn't that true? Finding that place, the access point, the point where we can come in, right? That soft spot. Be there, because there's peace there, instead of running away. Easy to run away, because there's always something else to do. It is hard to stay, which is why this is a truly transformative practice in training to be here, to stay, to not run away. And so if you think about the formal meditation practice, my guess is that those of us here are lay practitioners, not monastics. And so we do meditate as a training to learn to be present in our lives. It's not to meditate 18 hours a day. Maybe it's the same training as what a monastic does, but I am doing this, I hope, for those moments, those many moments of awakening where I really understand non-suffering, a truly open heart, but I'm really training to learn to stay, really training to learn to be present. And that takes energy, virya. We can learn to stay with the impermanence of our lives, with everything that is changing all the time, with the truth of dukkha, with the truth of knowing our interconnection. And so we can do this through different lists. We can practice with the 5 daily reflections, which I love to do. I am of the nature to age, to go through cycles of illness and wellness, to experience death of those I love, ultimately my own, to experience loss, to really experience the felt sense of loss, knowing that we will all experience this, that what we do really matters, the truth of karma, and that we can keep growing and learning. How exciting that is. The Buddha said, better than 100 years lived lazily and lacking in effort is one day lived with vigor and exertion. Better than 100 years lived lazily and lacking in effort is one day lived with vigor and exertion. And this comes from the Dhammapada. There's a whole section called the hundreds, and it's better than 100 years or 100 days lived with some affliction is one day. It only takes a moment to get it, is what he's saying. And so if you experience, what he's saying is experience this kind of vigor, this kind of presence, and then you'll know it. You won't unknow it. It'll be there for you. And you might think about, what have you learned in practice that you can't unlearn, that really supports who you are? Those are these beautiful moments of knowing deep in your bones what is true. Jack Kornfield says, you have been given the energy of the stars, this life force, and you have the capacity to do all kinds of things with it. May you use this energy to plant beautiful seeds, to work for justice, to care for others and this earth, and to do it in your own special way. May you use your meditation and your spiritual practices as a way to cultivate an open heart and your being to this possibility. You have been given the energy of the stars. Use it well. Use it well. So that leads us into a discussion of determination. But before I do that, what do you think? Do you have any questions, anything niggling about this conversation of energy, virya? Anybody at all? Or a question about anything else? Just want to take a pause to make space for us to talk with each other. Okay, I'll keep going. All right, determination, resolve, conviction, the Pali word adhitana. Now, it is not like a pressured, ramming determination. I like to think of it more as a gentle persistence, this thing that keeps me coming back, supported by the energy, right? It's like you could think of lots of different analogies for this, but the car can't go forward unless the gears are engaged, or it's got gas in the car, or electricity, whatever it is. resolve and conviction, knowing the direction you're going to go and why. This inner knowing, oh, this is good. And I'm talking about practice. You talk about it with anything. But it does require, I think, the other paramis of generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, energy. We haven't even talked about patience or truthfulness yet. So here's a way to think of it. So one determines to be generous, to refrain from doing harm, to let go of what needs to be relinquished, to discern and investigate, to bring energy, patience, and truthfulness to one's practice. I think that's Ajahn Suchito. I can't remember. So one determines, resolves to be generous, to refrain from doing harm, to let go of what needs to be relinquished, to let go when it's time to let go, says Mary Oliver, to discern and investigate, to bring energy, patience, and truthfulness to one's practice. So I'm going to read to you a piece from Sylvia, and I think it's my very favorite story in this book. And every time we talk about determination, I read it because I love it. So if you've heard this before, great, you get to hear it again. My son Colin's sixth grade teacher invited me to visit her class and talk to her students about the Buddha and meditation. They were completing a social studies unit on India. I was eager to present mindfulness as non-mysterious, sensible, and useful because, first of all, and most importantly, it is. Also, because I'm Colin's grandmother, I wanted to appear regular. I just have to pause to tell you that Colin now has two children, so this was a while ago. Mindfulness is about paying attention, I told the class. Think about how useful it is to be able to concentrate here in class. It's much easier to finish your assignments, isn't it, if you aren't distracted by the people around you? I saw all 26 students seem to be smiling, nodding, and agreeing. And I continued, when we pay attention carefully, we make wise decisions. Do you know what wise means? More nodding and smiling. My grandpa wasn't wise, one girl said. He kept on smoking cigarettes after he knew they were bad for him, and he got sick. Other students joined in with their stories of people they knew who were or weren't wise. I heard one boy said politely that people who meditate can tell the future or know your past or even guess what you're thinking right now. That's true, I responded. Some people do learn that skill by meditating, but mindfulness is about paying attention. I also heard, the same boy continued, that people who meditate can walk over hot coals and lie on beds of nails. We saw a picture of that in our book about India. That's true too, I answered. Sometimes people concentrate so hard that they don't feel pain in the way we usually do. Then they can do those special things that you saw in your book to prove how concentrated they are. Mindfulness is different. Mindfulness is paying attention in an ordinary way. Colin said, he went on, that you once met a woman who was such a good meditator that she could walk through walls. Did you? I did, I said, laughing, appreciating how polite and persistent this young man was in pursuing his point. She was old when I met her. She lived in Calcutta, but some of her students who were my teachers brought her to the United States so people here could meet her. Did you talk to her? He asked. I did, I said. Did you see her walk through walls? No, I didn't, I said. I guess I thought that if my teacher said she did, then she did. How did she do it? He asked. I saw that everyone seemed very interested. Well, I'm not exactly sure, I replied, but what people said was that she concentrated so carefully that her molecules all dissolved and that she could pass through walls and reconstitute herself on the other side. Everyone nodded as if that seemed reasonable. The questioner seemed content, and so the conversation continued on to questions about how to concentrate. We did some mindfulness exercises, some sitting still with eyes closed, some standing and moving. Everyone seemed pleased, and I had a good time. 3 days later, a large envelope arrived in my mail with 26 thank you letters. 25 began, Dear Sylvia, and one began, Dear Grandma. And all of them were very enthusiastic and thoughtful, citing particular parts of my presentation. I especially enjoyed when we stood up and did mindfulness moving around. I liked the stories you told about the Buddha. What I've been thinking about is how can I tell that I'm not paying attention when I'm not paying attention? And one letter said, Dear Sylvia, thank you for coming to visit our class. I enjoyed everything you said, but I'm still thinking about that woman who concentrated so hard that she could walk through walls. And I've been wondering, what if she got distracted in the middle of walking through the wall? Would she get stuck in the wall forever? Yours truly, Robert. I loved Robert's letter. In addition to being charmed by his uncomplicated, non-challenging, but nevertheless sincerely interested curiosity, I was delighted by his image of the perils of distraction. I realized how frequently I get stuck in walls. I get stuck in walls of lust or desire, thinking if only things were otherwise, then I would be happy. Or I get stuck in walls of anger and resentment when things don't go my way. If I'm not careful, I then begin to create scenarios of ever so subtle revenge, which further fatigue my mind and ultimately, when I realize what I've been doing, humiliate me because I'm actually a nice person. Every day I bump into mind walls, walls that feel solid because the impact is painful. Only when I remember that the walls are the habits of my own mind, that I built them, and they will continue to exist as long as I insist that they are real, can I stop building? Then my mind relaxes and I see clearly. I see that the walls are empty and I walk right through them. I also admired Robert's determination. He persisted as long as his mind was confused. Sometimes when I'm teaching far from home and people know me only through my books, someone will ask, how does it feel to have a clear mind all the time? And I respond, I wish I knew. My mind, like everyone else's, falls into habits, unpredictable and predictable traps, and I get confused. Practice is not about never getting trapped. It's about recognizing traps and choosing freedom. If I pay attention, I won't get stuck forever. I'm determined to do it. Isn't that fantastic? What are the walls we get stuck in? Do you picture studs in walls and getting stuck between the drywall? That's what I picture. We do get stuck, and it's natural. But can we bring the indefatigable energy to say, I recognize I'm stuck? And can we bring the care, the softness, the compassion, the wisdom to the moment of stuckness and say, oh, right, this is happening. And then the walls start to dissolve and it's not so painful. So there are a lot of analogies, there are a lot of different teachings around this. You know, the teaching of Mara. Who's familiar with Mara? So let me tell you, if you're not familiar with Mara, let's just be reminded. Mara is the personification of doubt, the doubting voice, maybe the inner critic, the one who is known to have tried to convince the Buddha that why did the Buddha want to be enlightened? He was just a person and it wasn't going to work anyway. And the Buddha persisted. He persisted and said, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to figure out suffering and the end of suffering. And he said, no, I have a right to be here. I will do this. So when those voices of doubt, the inner critic, shows itself for you, you can use what the Buddha said, which is, Mara, I see you. Mara, I see you. And this shines the light on what is happening here. And you can ask yourself, is this true? Is this not true? Is it necessary? Is it unnecessary? You can meet that voice of doubt with some energy, with some determination, some love. But be willing to stick with it I love you, keep going. I love you, keep going. To resolve to begin again. And every time we hear that phrase, come back, begin again, it's actually quite an open, serious invitation. It's not just one of those phrases, oh yeah, begin again. Well, we know that, but do we know it? What does it mean to say, all right, I have enough faith, I have enough trust and confidence that I will begin again? I think there's this really great quote from Martin Luther King that says something like, even when you can't see the top of the staircase, take the next step. That kind of trust, it's not blind faith. It's definitely not blind faith. This is based on what you already know to be true, that there's something really good here. Another beautiful Zen teaching that I come back to that actually restores and helps me when my faith is shaky is this teaching that says, when you fall down on the ground, it is the ground that helps you up. It's so beautiful and it's so true. When you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. We learn from the ground of our lives. And it's not up to you to figure it all out. We need each other. It is not upon you to finish the work, nor are you free to desist from it. That's from the Talmud. So we keep showing up. We keep doing it. It's said that in the Buddha's penultimate teaching, in addition to saying everything that arises ceases, the truth of impermanence, it's said that he said, strive on with diligence. Strive on with diligence. Also translated as move into the future with confidence. Trust, love, take the next step. Trust that. And we can't do it all, and we do need each other. And I'll end with this beautiful teaching from Rebecca Solnit, the brilliant teacher. She wrote an article for Tricycle last year, and she was talking about this issue of how do we bring our good energy and our determination, our resolve towards healing the world, and our ability to show up. And she was talking about what happened in Katrina in New Orleans when the levees broke, and how many people died and how many people were stuck on the top of roofs in the floods. And she said, you know, it's impossible to save everybody, but you got to try. But this is how she said you try. She said, get your boat in the water. You're not going to rescue everybody, but it's not your job to do it all by yourself. And rescuing somebody is deeply meaningful, even if you can't rescue everybody. Nobody rescued everybody, and a lot of people rescued somebody. Get your boat in the water and trust that you can do that. So let's sit for a minute and then we'll talk with each other. Okay. Thank you for being here. Let's end with our dedication of merit, and this comes from Norman Fisher. May I walk up the stairs to rise up in goodness with everyone, walk down the stairs to deepen my commitment to truth for the benefit of others, leave the house to go forth to do some good for someone else, and return home in the hope that all beings will one day return to their true home. May all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering. Thank you, everybody. I'll see you next time. Bye.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.